listening, that's what I was supposed to be talking about there. So,
keep you off guard.
Anyhow, so I was asked to talk about some of our national cattle evaluation approaches to efficiency evaluation. I've spent the majority of my tenure at that Colorado State University running all of our breed association evaluations. So I've got a fair bit of experience with a lot of the traits that we do. You know, some of the things I'm going to talk about, I didn't necessarily develop. I didn't necessarily think of them, but I've improved them, I've run them, and I'm pretty familiar with how they work. Okay? Dr. McNeil put up there earlier a big convoluted diagram of what he thinks efficiency is related to. And realistically, if I could ask any one of you out there what your definition of efficiency is, it would probably be exactly different. So we have challenges there. And I don't want to get into arguing on what I think efficiency is. What I really want to do is I want to talk about some of the tools that have been developed that breed associations are using to sort of account for as a way to measure efficiency or select for more efficient animals. And the first thing I'm going to talk about, and I've sort of lumped stability and longevity into reproductive efficiency. And we can argue one way or the other whether or not that those belong, you know, whether longevity is reproductive, whether stability is reproductive. And I would argue they are, but I can see arguments the other way as well. You know, we also do evaluations for feed efficiency. So, you know, one of the things I'm going to talk about today is mature cow maintenance energy. And that's an evaluation that was first presented it was actually the first BIF I've ever attended. That was in Omaha by John Evans, and he presented some of his dissertation work on mature cow maintenance energy. We're also doing some feed intake evaluations, some RFI evaluations, and I'm not really going to touch on that right now because I'm really sort of focusing more on the cow herd rather than any of those other measurements of efficiency. So reproductive efficiency. You know, I don't really want to go into a lot of detail on what stability is. I'm hoping most everybody in here knows what stability is. It was originally developed at Colorado State University by Warren Selling. I think he's left the room, so. But anyways, it's defined as the probability of surviving to a specific age point, given that they've had the opportunity to reach that age. Okay, you know, and the initial impetus behind the development of stability is we need to have cows that remain in production long enough to generate enough revenue to offset the cost of development. Okay? So back when Warren did the original stability evaluation in the mid-90s, this evaluation, they found that the break-even, or the break-even on these cows, was about 6 years of age. So we needed 5 calves in order for these cows to generate enough revenue to offset their cost of production. Okay? And that's for an individual animal. What we really need to do, though, is we really need to look at the entire herd, because we have animals that are falling out earlier, so we need enough cows that remain past their break-even point in order to offset or compensate for those animals that are culled early. Okay? And as Larry just showed, you know, a lot of that fallout rate is really early on in that 1 to 3 years of age. And so we needed some tool to select for these cows that are going to get past that break-even point. So it's not necessarily a longevity, it's more of an economic efficiency or a reproductive efficiency, because you're really looking at, you know, the production of calf from year to year. Okay? You know, and stability has been shown to be extremely valuable. You know, one of our graduate students just did a maternal index for one of our research herds up in Wyoming. You might be familiar with the Rouse Rancher if you hear people talking about it. And there's talking with other people who develop maternal indexes that include stability. Stability is accounting for 53 to 77% of the value of those maternal indexes. So, you know, we're half to three-quarters of the value of these maternal indexes is rolled up in stability. I mean, that's a huge number when you start thinking about economic efficiency or economic productivity. When I start talking about EPDs, I like to think about, you know, what do we really want for an EPD? You know, we're talking about the charge of this committee was, you know, what are we going to really evaluate? And we've got a lot of things such as feed intake and, you know, measuring all of these different traits. But what do we really need for a useful EPD? And first and foremost, I really think that we need to have usable data that can easily be collected. Okay? If we're going to have EPD with any sort of accuracy, we need to be able to collect data relatively easily, relatively simply, relatively cheaply, and use that for an evaluation. You know, do we have appropriate evaluation methods? You know, a lot of these evaluations, we're starting to talk about traits that really don't condone themselves to normal evaluation techniques. You know, we have a lot of non-normality in our data and everything. What we need is we need an evaluation method that is going to appropriately treat these so we're not introducing bias into our evaluation. You know, and the next two kind of go hand in hand. First, you know, it needs to be heritable. So these traits need to be heritable. And we need to have variation in breeding values. And those kind of go hand in hand. So the more heritable the trait is, the greater the variation we have in breeding values in order to make selection. But the last, and probably one of the most important, is it economically relevant? You know, is it tied to some sort of cost of production or income or revenue from production? Because, I mean, we really need another EPD out there that's not really helping us generate profit. I would say probably not. So think about those. As I start going through all of these evaluations, keep that in mind on how that relates to the traits I'm going to talk about here today. You know, this was Warren's initial stability evaluation, and I'm really doing it a disservice by summarizing it in a single slide. But, you know, evaluation of stability is, you know, whether or not they've been in the herd until 6 years of age. So it's really easy to collect data. I mean, we're collecting calf information. You know, we do that every year. We collect birth weights, we collect mating weights. So if you send that registration into your breed associations, they send us the data. So we're just looking at whether or not there's a calf available, and we can calculate a stability observation. So we can say, well, this calf was born, or this cow was born in 2000. We can say, well, she came and had a calf in 2006, so assuming that she's not going to skip from 2000 to 2006, we can say that, you know, she had a successful stability observation. The more data you put into this, the more restrictive you can get on your stability definition. So, for example, the Red Angus Association has implemented total herd reporting for the last 20 years. Is that about right? I'm going to say 20 years anyways. But they really restricted what their stability observation is. They say that she needs to have a calf in consecutive years without changing seasons, so she can't flip-flop from a spring calver to a fall calver. She has to have a calf each consecutive year she's in production. Otherwise, she gets an unsuccessful stability observation. You know, contemporary grouping for stability is relatively easy. You have, you know, we're just looking at breeder of the cow and the breeder of each calf, and so those are who we're comparing to. So we're comparing these cows among individual breeders, and then the observations are a 0 or 1. So yes, they stayed in the herd, or no, they didn't. And we can analyze these using a threshold model, which allows us to predict or have these resulting predictions expressed as a probability. Okay? So for an example, if you had two different sires here, we have an EPD of sire A who has an EPD of 0, and sire B who has an EPD of 10, we have sire B's progeny will have a 10% greater chance of staying in the herd until 6 years of age. Okay, so you can think of, you know, if they have 100 progeny, sire B will have 110 progeny at 6 years of age, and sire A will have 100 progeny. So you can think of it, or 10 more progeny at 6 years of age. And Warren found that heritability, it was heritable, 12%. I mean, it's a reproductive trait, so it's multi-heritable. And you know, even with that, you know, these breed associations. So I pulled off all the genetic trends since 1995 for stability for some of the breeds that we do EPDs for. You know, the gains haven't been large. Not all of them. Some of them are better than others. But we're seeing an increase in stability of about 0.33% to 1.23% per year. So, you know, genetic progress can be made. So, as I think if you mentioned earlier, it was someone was talking about, I believe it might have been a question in the audience. You know, one of the big issues we have with stability is the age at which observations or animals begin to receive observations. So the original definition is that female animals got an observation at 6 years of age. Okay? Well, their sire's got to be at least 8 years of age, okay, at that point. So realistically, by the time sires can have any sort of accuracy associated with their prediction, I mean, they're most likely dead or in a tank somewhere frozen. So that was one of the issues, and the reason this is important is because accuracy directly affects genetic progress. Okay? So if we look at, I put up here the equation for calculating rate of genetic change per year, and it's a function of intensity, which is I, and R, which is our accuracy, and our genetic variance and our generation. So if we can increase accuracy on these traits, we should theoretically be able to increase the rate of genetic progress. So how do we get higher accuracy? Okay. Well, you know, we do it all the time. We add correlated traits, right? We do that for carcass traits. We do that for weaning weight and birth weight. We do that for cavities we add in birth weight. So we can look at correlated traits. So some of the things we can do is we can look at traits measured at earlier ages. Okay, so you know we know stability at 6 is heritable, and that's our goal endpoint. But what about stability to 3 years of age? You know, how is that correlated to stability to 6 years of age? It's still the same data. We're just looking at an endpoint earlier on. We can also look at phenotypes other than stability, so such as we can look at mature weight, we can look at stroll circumference. You know, And another way to get higher accuracy is to use more data. And I'm going to talk about that here in a little bit. But a couple of the other issues with stability. Stability sort of has what Dr. McNeil says is an inefficient use of contemporary group information. So meaning, contemporary groups can be ever-changing. So as animals are bred, or if they're bred by a different breeder, we can have different animals that they're being compared to from one evaluation to the next, okay? Or as animals leave the herd, who they are compared to changes, okay? So contemporary groups change. So that can have an effect on the resulting genetic evaluation as well as the future genetic evaluation. And stability really doesn't do much with partial records, okay? What I mean by that is, in order to have a stability observation, they need to reach an endpoint, and then that's it. They're cut off. You know, they reach 6 years of age, they get a 1, or they get a 0. Okay? That really doesn't tell us anything about the earlier ages of stability, you know, if they haven't made it to 6 years yet. Or it doesn't really tell us anything about those animals who have gone past 6 years of age. That you've got that 14 or 16-year-old animal that's sitting in there. They've got the same stability observation as a 6-year-old, okay? So stability, our current stability evaluation doesn't handle those instances. So the first thing that we did this in discussion with the Simmental Association with Wade Schaefer, and then we were in discussions with the Red Angus Association as well. It's sort of an aggregate stability. So like I mentioned, you know, we know that stability to 6 years of age is heritable, okay? Well, what about 3, 4, 5? You know, are they heritable? I'm sure they are. What is their genetic relationship to 6 years of stability? So we actually did this. We came in and we said, okay, we are going to estimate stability for each of the different endpoints. So I've got 3-year, 4-year, 5-year, and 6-year stability on here. On the diagonal, we have heritability estimates. And as you can see here, heritability is increasing as the endpoint increases. Okay? And I am hypothesizing the reason is because you're having more animals fall out as you get older, so you're expressing more of the genetic potential to reach stability anyways. Okay? The important thing here is the genetic correlation. So we have a stability to 3 years of age, so that it's genetically correlated, which all the way over there on the left column, we have a genetic correlation of stability to 3 years of age to 6 and 0.64. So that's saying 64% of the genes that are associated with 3-year stability are also work towards 6-year stability. And you have, and I don't know why stage 4 and stage 6 drop down, the genetic correlation between stage 4 and stage 6. I would expect it to go up, but it does that in every breed that we do this for, that drops down like that. I mean, it's just, I don't really know why. It's a 5-year stability. But stage 5 and stage 6 is a genetic correlation of 0.88, so that means that 88% of the genes that contribute to, or 88% of the variation that contribute to 5-year stability are also contributing to 6-year stability. So what we've done is we've used 4 separate evaluations now. So we don't run these together in one single evaluation. Because we combine, we run single evaluations. We have a 3-year, 4-year, 5-year, and 6-year stability. We get EPDs for all of the animals from each of those evaluations. And then using selection index techniques, you're combining those into an aggregate 6-year stability observation. Okay? So if an animal has high accuracy for 6-year stability, using the earlier ages isn't really going to add accuracy. Okay? But if it has no accuracy for stability, we use earlier ages, then it's going to add quite a bit of accuracy. And what you can see in this example, we're seeing a maximum accuracy increase of 32%, or about 0.32 increase. Accuracy, which is rather large for just using data that was already available to us. We just weren't using it before. I wanted to touch on looking at correlated traits with stability as a manner to add accuracy. There really isn't a whole lot of research out there. I have found a couple of examples, but the reason I wanted to talk about this is it is genetically correlated with other traits. This first group was down in this study was conducted down in Brazil in some Valour cattle. But you know, if you're aging for its calving, that's worked out a -0.63 genetic correlation with stability. They're looking at 420 day weight and 420 day scrotal circumference. But there's other data that we could be using to increase this accuracy for stability. Okay. And also, there's some other studies that have done some risk factors associated with stability, and we're looking at calving after 730 days of age, any sort of dystocia experience, not weaning a calf, and then increases in cow weight EBV, and then weaning weight maternal EBV, increase the risk of being culled. Okay, so even her, this was more of a longevity study rather than a stability study. It's actually a survival analysis, but it increases the risk of animals leaving the herd prematurely. Okay. So I mentioned earlier that you know we can use the data on all animals. And one of the things I want to talk about, and this is some of the work that we've done with the American Yelby Association, and correlate, and it goes right into with some of the results that Larry Keane presented previously, is a multi-breed stability. So in a typical genetic evaluation, we do not include data on crossbred animals. And mainly because, you know, if we don't account for heterosis, the breeding values for crossbred animals will appear better than the breeding animals for purebred animals, just because of gene combination value. So if you look at the genetic model here, which is a phenotype is equal to a mean plus your genetics plus your gene combination value plus your environment. So gene combination value is the gene interactions that result in heterosis or hybrid vigor. And because they only pass on, you know, one set of chromosomes, it's not transmittable to the next generation. Okay? So what we've done for the American Yellow Association is we've accounted for heterosis and main breed effects. Okay, and then I've got the equation for retained hybrid vigor up there. But essentially, a retained hybrid vigor of 0 means the animal's a straight bred, and a retained hybrid vigor 1 is the F1 cross. Okay, and they're particularly concerned with Angus and you know, the Kelly Angus cross. The analysis was done in the same way as a categorical trait, contemporary group, heterosis, and main breed effects were fit. Some of the issues we've had down here is there really are no literature heterosis values for stability. So we're trying to find, you know, how do our evaluations make sense? Specifically, so we had to look at some cow longevity and convert that back to stability. So issues. So when we first did this, you know, I came out and everything ran real well. I got an estimate out and I started thinking about it. And I was like, wait a minute, you know, it's saying that as heterosis increased, the probability of stability staying in the herd decreased. I was like, that's not right, because, you know, depending on what literature you look at, literature suggests that as heterosis increases, longevity should increase by as much as 38%, and depending on some of the literature you're looking at, depending on the cross. So what we really found is this was a data structure issue, and we found that there, you know, really a lot of crossbred animals were not being recorded on herd inventory. They were not keeping crossbred females on the herd inventory. So that's one problem with stability is, you know, these crossbred females aren't being kept on inventory. But we were able to identify some breeders who started keeping animals on their inventory. But the only issue is, again, is we only have 3 years for 6 year stability, because in 2004, if you look at it, there's only 3 years of data there, just given the 6 year, the late occurring stability for age endpoints. But what we did find is when we looked at 3 year stability, 4 year stability, 5 year stability, that increases in heterosis did correspond to increases in stability. The good thing is as you increase the age endpoint, so as you went from 3 to 4 to 5, the value of heterosis increased as you got later on, okay? And when we went to 5 year stability, heterosis corresponded to an 11% increase in stability to 5 years of age, which is very similar to what Larry presented in his graphs just a little bit earlier. So, given the data issues we had, we were trying to figure out how can we compare this 11% to some sort of estimate. How does this? Are we in the ballpark? What were we having here? So, and again, I'm lining out all the problems we came across here. Is there's no 6 year stability. There's no heterosis for stability. You know, most everything heterosis estimates were associated with cow longevity, and there's really no Gilby Angus estimates that I was able to find. So Mark and I had to get a little creative. But we pulled some data from the Mean Animal Research Center and some of the papers that they presented. So we were looking at Gilby's relationship to other breeds. So over here on the left is a snapshot of a figure pulled out of Larry Keene's paper from a few years ago. I don't remember exactly what year it was. Not that long ago. Where he outlined the relationships amongst all the breeds. So in this figure, animals that are closer together are more related than animals that are farther apart. So if you look down here in the lower left corner, you have Angus and Red Angus. You know, they're relatively close together. And if you look at that arm that's going all the way out to the bottom right corner, those are Brahman animals. So you know they're more unrelated than the other animals. So we were able to find a study that had some Angus shorthorn crosses that's shown that heterosis increases longevity by about 0.93 years. And then we looked and found that Gelby, the between breed heterozygosity between Angus and Gelby and Angus and Shorthorn were about the same. So we were kind of saying, okay, well, let's see how our estimates compare to this longevity. So the first thing we had to do is we simulated two herds, okay? So I've got a base herd where I simulated a 50% stayability. So we adjust the cow retention rate for a 50% stayability at 5 years of age, okay? So then I had another herd where I increased that 5-year stability 11%. Okay, so I just readjusted the input retention rate and then calculated an average age for each herd. And then the difference in those should be, or in our minds, it should have been the increase in longevity of the herd by selecting on that stayability or that heterosis value. Okay? And what we received was a 0.77-year increase in stayability versus the 0.93 years that we calculated. So we felt pretty comfortable that we were in the right ballpark. The other thing I wanted to mention was if you extrapolated this out to 6 years of age, so you took our simulation and extrapolated it out to stability to 6 years of age, we actually saw an increase of 12% due to heterosis for stability, so for reaching 6 years stability. And this is actually, I believe it's going to be released this fall or this next time we go around for reviews. Is that correct, Susan? Hopefully, if I ever get you the file. So, anyways. So be looking for that. Reproductive efficiency. Now, this is a paper that Dr. McNeil worked on for the American Heritage Association. Where he's looking at sustained reproductive success as an indicator of longevity using survival analysis. Right? So the way I look at it is longevity is driving production efficiency because more mature cows were theoretically more efficient or more productive. We are having income increase because we have more mature cows who are more productive. Okay. More mature cows also correlates to reduced expenses because you have less heifer development costs. You know, and similar to stayability, this evaluation was developed for the Hereford breed, and he used the survival analysis. Now, I know nothing about survival analyses, so I'm not really going out on a limb, but just to explain what they are, a survival analysis is used to examine the length of time an individual survives or the time till failure. Okay? So we're not looking at cow death, but I guess we're looking at her as long as she survives in our herd or until she's, you know, removed from the herd. So the traditional evaluation of longevity has issues because we have extension late in life, right? Because, you know, animals are old by the time they have their observations expressed. We have non-normality of data, okay, because we have data. We have a lot of young animals and a lot fewer older animals. So that really doesn't lend itself to using some traditional evaluations of longevity. And then we have data censoring. Okay? So data censoring is if we assume an animal was in the herd, okay, she hasn't failed yet, so do we include her in? Because if we do, then we don't have a full observation, okay? But if we don't, are we biasing the data because we're not including them? So survival analyses allow for all of these different scenarios. So they allow for censored records, okay? They allow for changing contemporary groups, as I mentioned, with stability, as contemporary groups can change. They allow for partial observations. The stability to, I'm using stability as an example, the stability to 3 can be used, the stability to 9 can be used. She's still in the herd, right? But what he did tell me is they do have problems with animal models, and I'm not really sure why that is. I haven't put that much thought into it, to be honest with you. But they do have problems with an animal model. So I pulled this figure out. The good thing about this is it allows many different endpoints on how we can look at stability, so many different genetic predictions. Okay? So there's four different ways the genetic resulting genetic prediction can be expressed from a survival model. Okay? So at the bottom, at the very bottom, we have a relative risk of failure, and that's a ratio. Okay? So if the ratio is greater than one, they have a greater risk of failure. Okay? The ratio is less than one, they have a lower risk of failure. Above, we have on the top bar, on the very top of this chart, we have genetic standard deviation. So as genetic standard deviation increases, that individual has daughters who are going to be more fertile. As they go negative, or more to the right, that individual has daughters who are going to be less fertile. Okay? We can break this down into median failure time over on the left. So as the number of days increase, an individual has more fertile daughters, the median failure time of his daughters is going to increase because they're going to be around longer. And then we can have what you presented as success through the fourth cap as a percentage. So we have percentage of his daughters, of the size of daughters, who are successful through a fourth cap. So if you think about this, okay, so if you want an average son, okay, they have a relative risk failure of 1, a genetic standard deviation of 0, and in this data, they will have a median failure time of 817 days, and we will have a success through the fourth cap of 12.9%. Okay? So as sires get more, have daughters who are more fertile, we're going to move to the left and upwards in that chart. So I just wanted to point that out as we translate this. Sires with more fertile daughters are going to move left and upwards. Okay? And I think that this is one of the interesting things because it allows you to have different predictions depending on what you want to look at. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention today, you know, we talked about stability, and the title of this was Calvert Efficiency, and I thought it would be a disservice if I really didn't talk something about maintenance energy and the maintenance energy requirement that we have for the Red Angus Association. You know, all the speakers before me, they'd all talk about feed intake and maintenance energy. And this was a way for the Red Angus Association to account for Calvert maintenance energy requirements. Okay? So maintenance energy is defined as the amount of metabolizable energy required for maintenance. Okay? And it's that point of zero energy balance for net energy loss or net energy. If you look at some of the requirements of maintenance energy, you know, mature amount cow maintenance costs are about 70% of the total metabolizable energy that these females consume. So that's a large amount, that's a large value, so of costs that are going just for maintenance. And you can compare this to 35% of a growing animal's energy expenditure and 65% for the whole herd. So without going into a lot of details, you know, the NRC presents an equation to calculate the net energy for maintenance. Okay? And it's really essentially just body weight raised to the 3/4 power, so metabolic body weight, okay, multiplied by some thermal-neutral maintenance energy constant. Okay? So what John Evans did in his PhD work is he analyzed a mature weight genetic prediction. So he created a mature weight genetic prediction. I mean, he did more than just the genetic prediction because it took a little bit of math to figure out how to combine all this information, the genetic predictions, into a maintenance energy requirement. And this is really the very simplified Reader's Digest version of it. But the mature weight genetic prediction is analyzed as metabolic body weight, so we're adjusting it to a constant factor. So pre-adjusted to a condition score of 5. And then here we do a random regression of weight on age, okay? So we are considering the age or the weight endpoints of weaning weight, so 205-day weaning weight. We have yearling weight, and then 2 all the way up through 9 years of age, okay? So what we express mature weight as 5-year mature weight, CPD, and then the implied heritability of it is about 0.65, it's about 65% heritability. So it's a fairly heritable trait. So the one thing that we do is we index this mature weight with milk EPDs because we realize that animals who have higher milk potential are also going to have higher maintenance energy requirements just due to the fact that they have more tissue mass to maintain. Okay? And the current red Angus EPD is expressed in megacalories per month. So realistically, you know, when we talk about, you know, and I put this in here at the last minute, is when we start talking about efficiency, you know, why are we looking at maintenance energy? You know, it's a cost side of things, but realistically, this is the yearly wage genetic trend I pulled off of their website. Right? As you can see, it's been a steep increase since, you know, the mid to late 70s. If you look at the genetic correlation between yearling weight and mature weights, 0.7 is higher. So I would expect a mature weight genetic trend to be very similar. Okay? So since the mature weights increased, you would expect maintenance energy to be falling in the same fashion. And realistically, it has. If you look back here from 1970 on, we're increasing mature weight or maintenance energy requirements sort of in the same, similar fashion that we were with yearling weight. But look what happened when they started implementing the maintenance energy EPD in the early 2000s. So they sort of leveled off, and I'm not guessing saying that that's going to dip down. What I really think that's going to happen is this year it's going to come up and then just level off. Okay? So they're really keeping in check the maintenance requirements of the cowherd, okay, while still selecting for growth. And I think that that's really what's going on here. But anyways, that's all I've got. I don't really know what time it is or anything. But in conclusion, we've got three different efficiency predictions. You know, two of which are currently being used at the breed association level. And realistically, you know, I think all of these, the breed associations really want these to be economically relevant. I think they are. The data is fairly easily collected because we're just looking at weights. We're looking, you know, weights are easy to collect. Body condition scores are easy to collect. Calf information is easy to collect. You know, they're heritable. And then we've got variation among those resulting.
Let's thank Scott.